This is CliffCentral.com.
Our guest is the German ambassador, Martin Schäfer, who's the German ambassador in South Africa. And when I first met him, it was at the Friedrich Naumann Stiftung's 60th birthday party. And I was struck by how candid he was about the links between German liberalism and South African democracy, and the fact that Germany had quite a role to play in helping many liberal institutions found themselves and grow themselves in South Africa, something I think we both share as students of history. I also enjoyed the fact that he brought up the fall of the Berlin Wall and President de Klerk's comments related to his decision to ring in the changes at the time. So you see, Ambassador, I was listening to you.
Good morning. I try to listen to you today, too.
Thank you so much.
That's a good basis for a conversation, is it not?
I hope so. I've also spent the last 2 years, I was in Berlin last year and the year before, and found the place to be absolutely the most interesting city in Europe at the moment. I think a lot of people would agree with me that there is a lot going on there. There's an extraordinary energy. It seems like a very cool place for multiculturalism, for democracy, for free speech, for a lot of other good things.
Well, I think Berlin is about to recover the place as a hub for cultural creativity, cultural development that it had in the 30s. And we destroyed that ourselves with this, with the Nazi times. Berlin in the 20s was, so to speak, the center of the world, maybe with New York. And we are trying to get back to that. And I have been living in, before I came to South Africa, in Berlin. What a fantastic city. It's a bit chaotic.
It is chaotic.
In that sense, a bit South African, I would say.
Yeah.
But it's wonderful. It's a place that gives home to people from all walks of life.
Well, there's a lot about Germany that we can talk about just now, but you yourself weren't born in Berlin. You were born in Bremen.
Yes.
And West Germany at the time,
yes,
was a very different place to what Germany as a whole is now. What was it like? Because I often have people in other countries ask me, what was it like to grow up in apartheid South Africa? I went to school, probably the majority of my high school was spent in a free South Africa. But the time before, as an innocent child, you kind of don't really understand the huge import of the things going on around you. And later when you do come to comprehend them, you see them through a childish lens. But I suppose for you, growing up in Germany, I don't know whether it was something that was evident to you at a young age, but there was always this hangover of what had happened during the World Wars, what the legacy of World War II was for Germany. And growing up there must have been quite an interesting thing. There must have been stuff that you picked up on early on in your political education, or certainly in your education generally, that would have colored the person that you are today.
My youth, and I think the youth of most of the people of my generation in Western Germany was a fabulous one. We lived in a free country which guaranteed the freedom of speech. There was no inhibitions whatsoever. You could revolt against your parents, you could revolt against your teachers, against your state. You can engage in leftist or rightist political activities and nobody would bother, which in a sense, if you want, is something which for a young person is not easy, because if there's nothing to revolt against that you can try to throw over, then it becomes a bit boring too. And I must say it is only after the end of this Federal Republic of Germany, before reunification, that I realized in what kind of a state of affairs we were living, because we were supposed to be the battleground for the Third World War. And there were, in the course of the history of the Cold War in the 60s, mostly in the 60s, but also with the armament debate and the SS-20 on the one hand side and the cruise missiles on the other hand side, there was always the danger that Germany would become again the battleground between the Americans and the Soviet Union. And not so much myself, I don't know why I didn't sense that so much, but many of the people in my generation felt that very much, this big weight of the danger that something might happen that puts all our wonderful free and democratic life
at risk,
destruction. And I think that is something that Germans and South Africans share, that this imminent danger of a third world war, the imminent danger that with the collapse of communism, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, with the end of the Cold War, that would be an explosion of violence. And that probably was the scenario that was more probable than the peaceful solution, where the Soviet Union crumbled, disappeared, and nothing happened. So we share, I think, with South Africa this feeling that against all odds, things can turn out all right. We got our unification with the consent of all our neighbors. We continue to live in peace and harmony with all our neighbors, including the Brits, who are going to leave the European Union now. We continue to be friends and partners with them, despite a decision that is hard to understand for us. And in South Africa, it's a bit the same. It was against all odds, I believe, from a perspective of, say, your youth at the end of the 80s, that apartheid would disappear without a civil war. But it did. And you, in South Africa, you were able to make this peaceful transition. You were able to create a country that can dream of the Rainbow Nation, where, for the first time in the history of your country, conflict resolution is not done by violence, but by ways of democratic, sometimes anarchic, sometimes chaotic, sometimes difficult, but debates. And that is exactly, I think, what we share with you.
When I look, and we'll get into the relationship between South Africa and Germany in a second, you've already hinted at it, and it's something that's very much worth exploring, because Germany has had a very powerful and positive role to play in South Africa post-democracy. But the German political system is, to an outsider, astonishingly complicated. I know to Germans it seems almost second nature. There's this federal system. There are different kinds of elections that are held. There's a lot of coalition politics that take place. There are small parties and large parties, and there are changes constantly going on, despite the fact that we've got Frau Merkel at the middle of this, that is almost, she's become kind of a, I hesitate to say it because I don't want it to sound like a criticism, but she's become almost a fixture in German politics, which around her is always changing. The fact that Germany occupies this extraordinarily powerful position within the European Union, that the German economy is this juggernaut all of its own, all of these things combine to make Germany a country that can't be ignored, but whose politics are remarkable in that they are quite different to anywhere else in the world. I don't think there's a, you know, you could say the parliamentary system that started in England has been exported to various places, mostly English colonies, and it's taken root there. The American presidential system, and there's a kind of federalism in America too. But German federalism and German politics is almost unique. There aren't a lot of examples of that anywhere in the world.
I think that's true. I think it's a consequence of our history, mainly a consequence of the Third Reich, of the 12 years of Nazi rule in Germany, where all the checks and balances of a constitutional order of the Weimar Republic were wiped away in a couple of weeks, and where we had learned our lesson, and where certainly the Allies tried to explain to us that if you want to come back to a democratic rule of law dispensation, you better find a way of doing that that makes sure that something like what happened in 1933 with the Machtergreifung, with the grab of power by Adolf Hitler, could never happen again. And the result is indeed a very complicated system of checks and balances, horizontally and vertically, which makes sure that the Chancellor, as head of government, Angela Merkel at the moment, of course, has the right to determine the direction, the political direction, the central government, the federal government at least, takes. But all that also, as you rightly point out, is very complicated because no chancellor, there's with one exception in, at the end of the 50s, had ever ruled with an absolute majority. So it was always...
Was that Adenauer?
That was Adenauer in 1957, who won the elections with and was elected chancellor with his own, with one vote ahead, and that was his own vote. So he was a chancellor who could rule with an absolute majority for 4 years until 1961. After that and before that, it never had happened, which means that a chancellor cannot do what he wants or she wants, but needs always the consent not only of her government, which is constituted of many different, well, several different political parties, but also of the different factions in the Bundestag, which constitute the majority. In foreign policy, for example, it's quite difficult to understand for people from presidential regimes, such as the French, the American, or the South African, that a foreign minister is not necessarily taking instructions from the chancellor, because he is most of the times in the history of the Federal Republic of Germany from a different political party. He's the vice chancellor, but he has his own political legitimacy and his own political objectives that not necessarily 100% coincide with what the political party of the chancellor would want to achieve.
So, and then, of course, there's a president as well.
Well, we have a federal president, but that is a symbolic figure that is the head of state that represents the unity of the country, which in time, who has in times of constitutional crises certain prerogatives, whether or not to dissolve parliament, whether or not to call for new elections. But we have had such a stable system since 1949 that such an important political role in decision-making of a federal president has happened once or twice in the last 70 years.
Well, what's interesting, too, is that all of this federal structure also goes back long before the Weimar Republic and so much more that came before it. These provinces were originally the old kingdoms of what Bismarck put together into the first kind of German empire, the original Prussian kingdoms.
The cultural unity and the linguistic unity of the country, of the people that spoke German, came before the political unity of the country. And it was the Iron Chancellor Bismarck, who in 71, with the help of a bit of a ruthless politics and a couple of wars, achieved this political unity of the country in 1870, but before that, for hundreds of years, there had been the Roman Empire of the German nation, which was not so much of a political entity, certainly in the years before it was destroyed by Napoleon, but it was a cultural entity where people felt that they belonged to the same kind of culture and nation without that being found in the political structure of the country. And then in the course of the 19th century, there was a huge nationalistic development, mainly by students from universities who demanded political unity. And that's where the colors of the German flag, as it is now, the black, red, and gold, were invented, which is now the colors of, you know, German unity and the German state.
But in some ways, this is probably a useful incidence in history and a useful example for South Africa. We often find ourselves asking, well, what is it that holds us together? Because all of these disparate states found a way to come together culturally and linguistically. So it can be done. And in South Africa, we often have to look for the things that tie us together rather than the things that separate us. And there may be some lessons to be learned.
Well, in South Africa, the Union of South Africa was a result of a cruel and vicious war too.
Mm.
And it was a federation, it was a union, composed of two former Cape colonies and two former Boer republics. And in some way you can explain the history of South Africa with all the problems, challenges and obstacles involved in bringing about a South African nation after the Boer War until 1902, and the life within the Union of South Africa. And I think that many books have been written about it. And when I think about these times, I always try to draw parallels, of course, with the history of my country, of my continent. There are a number of parallels, I think.
There are also a large number of German people in South Africa. We have a very large German community, I think. Pretoria might be the biggest German community in the Southern Hemisphere, or something like that.
I don't think that's true. What we have is a new phenomenon that we call swallows.
Yes,
where people that can afford it don't migrate as they would have, say, two or three generations ago, where you had to decide where you live. But with means of communication and transport nowadays, it's easy to spend, to always run after the sun.
So they spend summer here and summer in Europe.
Well, it's a bit like the South African government, say, until the beginning of the 90s, where you would reside in Pretoria when the weather's nice here and move to Cape Town for the opening of Parliament when the weather's nice there.
But we do have some institutions that represent the German community in South Africa. There's a very strong Deutsche Schule in both Pretoria and Johannesburg.
And in Cape Town, yeah.
There are communities that speak the language. I had friends at school and at university with me who were of either German descent or had German family, and so I think there are large communities.
Well, with Jan van Riebeck already in 1652, the first Germans came because the mercenaries and the people that the merchants from Amsterdam employed were in large part Germans. So the German language has arrived here more than 350 years ago. But what I feel now that I'm here for a little bit more than a year is there's some dramatic change. You know, the German community, just like the Greek, Portuguese or Jewish communities in South Africa, they were pretty much, how should I say, for lack of a better word, they were segregated.
Yeah.
They wanted to stick with themselves. They created their own sports clubs. They created their own schools. They created their own places where they would spend time together. And for the father of a young German boy or girl or mother, it would have been an insult if that boy or girl would not marry someone from the same cultural group. But that is something that is about to disappear, not only in the German community, I feel. And I think, you know, there might be people that think, oh, this is all sad because there's a part of a culture, the German culture or the Greek or the Portuguese culture in South Africa disappearing. It might be. But at the same time, that's a normal process in nation building.
Assimilation, right?
Yes, exactly. And by the way, it's part of a problem for our German schools who have a proud history of, in the case of the German school here in Johannesburg, of more than 120 years of helping yourselves as a community to educate your children. And when, as nowadays is more the rule, only one of the parents speaks German and speaks German with the children, it is not so easy for the boys and girls to pick up the language as a maternal language. So it's not so easy to enter the German school with the perfect knowledge of the German language that you would normally need. So there we need to change too, and the German schools here in this country, and I'm very proud of that, I must say, have been starting in the 80s already to undermine the apartheid regime, because they were given a lot of funds from Germany to provide their education also to people from formerly at that time disadvantaged backgrounds. And we have thousands and thousands of young learners who since the 80s have made their matric in our German schools. That's a wonderful melting pot. Whenever you go there, you might have been there, Gareth. It's wonderful to be there because the people come from all walks of life, and you know, nobody imposes any form of the German culture on them. But I think what is specific about this German schools is they learn how to learn, and you get an instruction which is not, you have to learn this by heart and then reproduce that, but you learn in the course of the time in school to properly prepare for a university career in being told and taught how to acquire knowledge.
So when I met you at the Naumann Stiftung's 60th birthday, they're an important institution. They're one of many that emanate from Germany and are represented all over the world. And their work in particular has to do with free expression, has to do with liberal ideas, freedom. And these are things that matter to the German government. They matter to most people who say that they care about democracy and liberalism. But very few people really interrogate these things. The Naumann Stiftung does some heavy lifting in respect to this. They host many events with the goal of trying to get people to promote and embody and embolden democracy and freedom all over the world. How important is it for your embassy to be involved with non-government organizations or partly governmental organizations like this that are seeing to it that countries as far and wide as South Africa and Burma and Canada and Venezuela all get to hear these ideas?
Well, you've pointed out that our political system, because of the experiences of history, is as it is. in that it shares power amongst many different players. And our political foundations are exactly a product of that. Every political party that is represented in our parliament, the German Bundestag, gets funds to run a political foundation that is close to the ideological thinking of that political party. And those political foundations do their work in our country at home, which is mainly political education for young people. But they have been, as the Friedrich Naumann Stiftung, they have been engaged in work abroad too. And I think there's no other country, maybe a bit the Americans with their foundations that are active abroad too, which can dig as deep as we can into societies like South Africa, because we not limit ourselves in our foreign policy to the classical diplomatic work that I would do or that my team would do.
Yes.
But we would have in South Africa 6 different political foundations who have their bases here, who have been here for decades, who engage in partnerships and cooperation with non-governmental organizations or with political parties in South Africa and elsewhere in the world who they feel ideologically close to.
Right.
And that gives us the opportunity to create networks that are so much deeper than what you would be able to do if you were only present with an embassy and with an ambassador. I don't have the time, and it is not my job to be engaging with so many NGOs as we can do that with our political foundations. And you have pointed out the great work of the Naumann Foundation. I share that view, that they have been very important and even quite instrumental in the political changes in this country, when at a time when what is now the Democratic Alliance was a little splinter party with a little less than 1% of the vote, they engaged in some strategic political cooperation between the Liberal Party in Germany and the Democratic Party at the time in South Africa. And it was always in the decades that they have been cooperating with one another, an exchange on eye level, because there's some things that our German liberals could learn from the South Africans and vice versa.
Absolutely.
And I believe, and if you want to discuss that, I'd be happy to do so. Liberalism in Africa, certainly with the reality check of poverty, inequality, and unemployment in South Africa, is a different beast than it would be in countries which are a lot more homogeneous, a lot more equal, like mine. And I think liberalism as a philosophical concept is wonderful. It's the basis for the freedoms we enjoy. It's the basis for our constitution, for the wonderful South African constitution. But it needs some prerequisites for everybody to be able to enjoy the benefits of liberalism.
Well, what do you think the state of liberalism in Africa is?
Well, I would think that the most noble ideal of liberalism is the equality of opportunities, that wherever you're born, whatever color of your skin might be, whatever the wealth and prosperity of your parents might be, it is an obligation not only for the state, but for society, for each one, to make sure that everybody gets the chance to make the best of his life. And it's a bit like the invisible hand. When you have a system where everybody gets equal opportunities, society as a whole benefits from it. And the truth of the matter is that in countries, on the African continent, and also in South Africa, we don't have a situation where there's equal opportunities. When you are born in the wrong place in South Africa, the risk of being the victim of violent crime, the probabilities that you have a good life and you get opportunities to have good education, that you get a matric and go to university, are not there. So that, of course, means that in order to have a liberal society, you need to make sure that those that don't have equal opportunities get them as quickly as possible. And that's, I think, what it's all about. And I think that's the most noble task for each and every of the political parties in South Africa, to provide that opportunity to each and every young South African.
Is that why you think liberalism might not be as en vogue as it might be in countries where the societies are more homogenous and there is more equality? Because it isn't a practical priority for people. Survival might be.
Exactly.
And if you're living in survival mode, you can't dedicate your mind and your thoughts and your philosophies to high-minded ideals like liberalism?
Well, there's, I think there's many examples that even in countries that struggle and where it is, as you say, that you need to fight to get bread on the table for your children in the morning or in the evening, where you can still embrace liberal ideas. I think there's nothing that would speak against that. But in order to, you know, practically put in place a system that you could rightfully call liberal, it needs a different set of policies. And it might entail subsidies. It might entail something like affirmative action to make sure that everybody has equal opportunities. In my country, there's poverty too, but that's all a relative concept. In my country, there's unequal opportunities too, but by and large, I would say, wherever you're born, in the north or the south, as the son or daughter of a rich or a poor family, the state and society offers you opportunities that you can use or not use. That's your choice. And if you have a system like that in place, I think it's an expression of liberalism to say you are the captain of your destiny. And it is your choice what you make out of your life. And if you don't succeed, that's not so much the problem of society, it's your problem. But for that, I cannot repeat that often enough. You need a society, a state that provides equal opportunities to a certain extent. And here in South Africa, we're quite far away from that.
We've got a lot of work to do.
Yes.
So what does your work in South Africa involve? I imagine a lot of people see an ambassador as someone who spends most of the day shaking hands and opening buildings and receiving phone calls and relaying diplomatic communiques and these kinds of things. Of course, that's part of it, but it can't be the majority of what you do. So what is your day-to-day business?
Well, you represent, you're the former representative of another sovereign state. That is why, from the history of diplomacy, there's a lot of formalities involved, and you ridiculously get called Your Excellency all the time, and where you would prefer to be called by your first name. But in essence, it is to represent the interests and the values of the country you come from. And in many countries of the world, it's not easy to combine the two, because you might have interests, trade interests, investment interests, protecting, you know, the investors of your home country in the country where you happen to reside in. And then you represent values of a country. In our case, the values of our constitution, the fact that we have learned from history, the fact that we have been embraced with open arms by the international community after the horrific and singular events of the Holocaust and the Second World War. And I think we have espoused, you know, the values of the rule of law, of democracy, of liberalism. We talked about that. And I try to the best of my abilities to represent those values. And my colleagues in other countries would do the same. And in South Africa, it's something of an easy thing to do, because you have many situations in which interests and values might not completely coincide or concur. But here in South Africa, say 99%, that's very easy, because South Africa shares the same values we share. And our interest here in Africa is to make a little bit of a contribution to a positive and benign and peaceful and a development of equal opportunities and prosperity for all over the continent and in South Africa. And for that, to achieve, we engage in a lot of activities. We have quite considerable trade. I think we are the second, almost the biggest trade partner. The Chinese are a little bit bigger than us. We are the biggest trade partner as Germany with South Africa. There's a lot of many, many thousands of containers being exchanged every month between our countries. There is, we cooperate with South Africa on a number of issues that will define the fate of humanity in the 21st century, on development policy, on making sure that we eradicate poverty in South Africa and the world, in tackling climate change, because South Africa, certainly the west coast of South Africa, is one of the most vulnerable places and regions in terms of climate change. So we engage in scientific cooperation, in political cooperation, to make sure that we together tackle the challenges of the 21st century with a partner that is important to us, that is the biggest democracy and the biggest economy in our on our sister continent. And there's a lot of things to do to put that into practice. We spend something beyond 200 million euros, which is some up to 4 billion rand every year on our cooperation with South Africa. We have big parts of our development policy that we define and share with South Africa. We engage in climate policy. We cooperate on trade and investment issues. So there's a broad range of issues that that we share with South Africa. Here and there we have diverging views, but there it's important to keep on continuing to look for the dialogue.
What are the areas of contention? You said, and I think you're right, 90-something percent of what we discuss is stuff that we have in common. South Africa and Germany have walked similar paths. You referred to that in that speech that I referred to in the opening. But there are areas where we do sometimes not see the same picture and not see the same preferred outcome.
Yes, we would give you an example on foreign policy in quite a present one. We would share, both of us, the view that we have to do everything in our power to preserve a peaceful, rules-based international order with all the instruments and institutions that were put in place after the Second World War, and first and foremost the United Nations. But then, how to put that in practice? We would, and we do have, diverging views, for example, on the role of the international community and of the United Nations in particular on what is happening in Venezuela. We feel that what is happening in Venezuela is a threat to international peace and security, which gives the international community and the United Nations and the Security Council of the United Nations a reason to deal with the matter, and to discuss things on the international arena, where South Africa would hold the view that Venezuela is a sovereign state.
We should not interfere.
And it is not the role of the international community to interfere with internal matters of a sovereign state.
And yet?
No, and we would then try to engage in a debate. I would try to understand the South African point of view, relate my understanding of the South African point of view to my colleagues in Berlin, and continue to look for solutions for a desperate situation for millions of people in Venezuela. There's millions of refugees, which is for us the trigger to say it is far beyond a national matter, because it's a matter, at least a regional matter, for the neighboring countries.
And ask Colombia, they'll tell you.
For example, exactly. Yeah. Well, and I think about the history of South Africa and also the history of the African National Congress. If we had said, say, in the middle of the 80s, in the face of a incredibly moving campaign, one man, one vote in South Africa, and Free Mandela, if we had said in
sovereign nation, we can't interfere.
Exactly. In the middle of the 80s, we would have told the ANC, you know what? Yes, I think it's not all that nice what is happening in South Africa. And yes, it's a bit nasty that blacks don't have the right to vote. But, you know, it's a sovereign state, and we're not going to interfere. What would have been the reaction of the African National Congress at the time? They would have said, well, you know, what cold-blooded, cold-hearted people you are, that you don't help us overcome this evil regime. And, well, the truth of the matter is that, until the 80s, the position of the West in time terms of the Cold War was as it was. And the ANC was on the right side of history, and it took us a bit of time to get on that side too. But we did, and we did forcefully. And we implemented sanctions against the apartheid regime, and we told the leaders of the apartheid regime, P.W. Botha was in Bonn at the times, and then F.W. de Klerk was too, that you have to change what needs to be changed, and we are willing to support that process. And we did, and we did it in quite a reliable and consistent manner, I would say.
I'm also interested in your own history. You've spent an enormous amount of time. You're a hugely qualified man, and I mean PhDs in law and degrees in administration from the École Nationale d'Administration Publique in Paris, You've done lots of work at the German Foreign Office. You also worked at the German Foreign Office between 98 and 99, the embassy in Kiev, Santiago in Chile. So you've done a lot of this really hard work in diplomacy and foreign relations. So you must have a very interesting bird's eye view then of world politics. And if you weren't representing Germany, I suppose we could have dinner conversations that would be fascinating. And I think a lot of people would take huge amounts of tremendously useful information out of. But when you look at the situation in the European Union at the moment, and we consider all of the political and the demographic troubles that Germany in particular, but Europe in general, are going through, do you see any kind of long-term resolution to these problems? Do you see some kind of accommodation? Do you see some kind of problem in the rise of right-wing populism in Europe? I mean, these are things that everybody's talking about, but nobody really knows enough to address them in a comprehensive manner that you might.
It is, I think, it's always difficult to understand the present before it becomes history. And we have thousands and thousands of historians whose job it is to explain what had happened in the past and maybe draw conclusions for the present and the future. I had a foreign minister for which I work quite closely who said, you live life ahead the way you do, and he meant it in terms of his or anybody's private life, but I think it holds true for politics too, and then it's only later that you start to understand what really happened. I think the biggest threat to the stability of our wonderful liberal democratic rule of law dispensations is at the moment the return of right-wing populism. There's a magnificent book that I'm reading at the moment by one of the former foreign secretaries of the United States, of Madeleine Albright, who has a history. She came from Europe. She was a Czechoslovakian Jew, right. Had to fled the Nazis, and she wrote a book called A Warning, Fascism. And she is painting a picture of fascism creeping back into the politics of the world and also the Western world. It's hard to understand, for me at least, why this has all come about, but it must be that in our Western world, politics, in the view of many of the citizens, has become too aloof and too globalized, and that, you know, that all the values that we espoused of liberalism and globalization and of international solidarity do not coincide so much anymore with the realities of the people, because it's easy to say that globalization has a bottom line, that at least there's more people winning and benefiting from it than losing from it. But you should never neglect that there's losers from globalization. I think the reason that someone like Donald Trump was able to become the president of the United States of America is the fact that he was able to embrace and embody the grievances of people that feel left behind by politics, liberal politics of globalization. I think you have to take that seriously in a democratic dispensation.
But you pointed out something there that could also be true for capitalism. So while people criticize globalism, a part of what they're criticizing is also capitalism. You hear a lot of young people saying, well, capitalism is the problem. While capitalism has pulled millions of people out of poverty, and the free market is a very powerful vehicle for emancipating people, it has led to a resurgence, just as fascism has come to rise itself again in the shadow of globalism. So socialism finds itself fertile ground in the shadow of people who complain about capitalism.
I agree.
And you do see the rise of this populism on both sides, which is of great concern.
Well, I think the example of my country, even the history of South Africa, exemplifies that the ideological battles of the last century about what is better, a socialistic or communist regime or capitalism, are issues that we should and have left long behind.
You would
my
think
country,
so. Well, you'd only need to pick up a few history books to.
Well, if I look at the history of my country and the prosperity that we have been able to create after the Second World War, it was our fault, but our country was completely destroyed. The industrial basis was gone. 80% of the cities was just rubble. And we are now amongst the most prosperous nations of the world. And what happened was we, and I think that's the recipe that is the right one for South Africa too, we understood with all the skepticism that Germans always had vis-a-vis a capitalist Anglo-Saxon kind of society order, is that the dynamics that capitalism can generate must be used and can be tamed. And we call that social market economy, which means that you use the market economy principle to create wealth, but then through a lot of political means, legislation, tax, and other, you would channel the funds that are generated by the dynamics of capitalism into social justice and transformation. And I think that is exactly the concept that was embraced in 1994 by the African National Congress. People speak here of the National Democratic Revolution, and they speak of GEAR, and there's a lot of difficult abbreviations with a lot of, you know, political papers behind it, and it's difficult to understand. In essence, as I understand it, it's a system where the country, the ruling party, and the citizens accept the principle of a market economy with some limitations, because the ANC finds it right to have a lot of state-owned enterprises like other countries too. We have a number of state-owned enterprises too. And then you try to use the good things coming out of it, the tax resources, the education, the vocational training, the jobs, all that is created by the dynamics of capitalism to make the society a better place. And capitalism, if you want, just as diplomacy, is a means to an end. And you have to define the political objective. What is the end of what you want to achieve? And I think in South Africa, to want to eradicate capitalism, and by that refusing to use and want to use the dynamics it generates, would be a grave mistake. That's my personal point of view. Of course, the South African electorate takes the decision whatever it wants. And I think also that investments from outside and within the country are probably the most important trigger for economic development. That is why I work every day to convince Germans and European investors that this is the right place to come, because there's money to be made. That's why investors come. But mm-hmm. There's also a social role to play. And I can safely say that the huge majority of the German entrepreneurs and businessmen and companies that are present here, most of which have been here for generations, consider themselves to be corporate citizens. They are not only here to make the quick buck, but they are here because they understand that the role of a company and of an entrepreneur is a lot more than just making money. It's about bringing about change and transformation. And there's a lot of ways to do that.
There have been some controversial things that have happened in respect of our Foreign Office, our Department of International Relations and Cooperation, and their take on what this foreign investment might mean, and occasionally a few miscommunications from the South African side. Does that put you off, or does it leave you more resolute to continue the relationship building?
No, it doesn't put me off. It took me by surprise to some extent, I must say, because what I did with a number of colleagues already quite a long time ago was to heed the call of the president of the country, who was decided to invite foreign investors to come to South Africa. He set himself a very ambitious goal to bring in 300 billion rand of, no, what was it, 100 billion dollars of investment into the country, because I think in his understanding, investments are the necessary prerequisite for growth and development. And we heeded the call, and we wanted to join forces in promising our contribution to that, which we did, but at the same time be honest with good friends and partners in saying that there are a number of challenges that we hear from every day from our investors about the investment climate in the country. And that's why we try to...
It's not charity, it's investment.
Yes, yes, it is. People don't come because they love South Africa, or because they have compassion for South Africa. Most of them do, because the investors and capitalists are human beings too. But they come here because they look for investment opportunities that that at the end of the day will make them earn some money. And we wanted to be good friends and partners in telling our South African counterparts, ministers, advisors, civil servants, and people from the business community, what we feel are the biggest and most important challenges or even obstacles in the way to foreign direct investment. And it was never meant to be criticism, but it was meant to be a contribution. And that indeed was misunderstood here and there, but I think those misunderstandings have been put aside. And maybe just one word about the role of an ambassador, because that's maybe the red line in the talk we have. Diplomacy comes from times when kings had to interact with one another, and it was always a question of war and peace. And a diplomat enjoys diplomatic immunity because of the historic experience that one king sends a poor chap to another court with the wrong message that he got his head chopped off. And the diplomatic immunity is the consequence of that, to give diplomacy the space where people can negotiate, first of all, about war and peace, but now also about a lot of other issues, because in the 21st century, diplomacy is a lot more than the question of war and peace, in a atmosphere of dialogue. But it has evolved ever since. It is not so much that a diplomat's role in our concept of it would be that you sit in a back room where you talk to a minister and tell him what you think your country finds good or bad or what should be done.
Sure.
No, diplomacy is public diplomacy. Diplomacy is engaging with the civil society in the country you're at. And that's why I'm with you, that's why I talk with you, and I hope one or the other finds it interesting what we have to say, and that's why I engage with NGOs, that's why I engage with other political parties, and that's all part and parcel of a modern definition of the job of a diplomat.
Do you enjoy the job?
I do, certainly here in South Africa. This is the best place a diplomat can possibly be in, because usually you have the choice between Copenhagen and Kabul, which means that with a friend like Denmark on the border to Germany, life is wonderful. It's a fabulous place where you can do whatever you like.
Sure.
But it's a bit boring because there's no issues, no friction, there's nothing to solve. And then Kabul is the other thing. It's a country that tries to get out of a deeply enrooted civil war. There's a lot of challenges, and my country does its best and invests a lot of money to help them to do that. But life is shit in Kabul because you live behind concrete walls and you can't go out and it's dangerous.
Absolutely.
And South Africa offers you the best of both worlds because it's an accommodating place. It's a welcoming place. It's a place where you have great people.
Do your family like it here?
They love it here. And at the same time, South Africa, let me say that, Gareth, at the end, is a very complicated country too, which is, if you want, a paradise for diplomats. You know, if in this world of diplomacy where you change posts every 3 years and you acquire a certain pattern of analyzing a country and doing your job right, there are countries that are less complicated than South Africa, where after a year or so you would say,
I figured this one out.
Yes, and in South Africa you never figured it out. I don't think any South African can figure this country out, because South Africa is, you know, the melting pot of so many different people, cultures, languages, histories, perceptions, and there's so many incredibly fascinating, great people that you can meet every day. So the least thing that anybody in South Africa from my profession could say, that it gets ever boring. It never does. And it's always surprising, I can tell you.
Well, I can tell you it's been a great pleasure to sit down and talk to you. You're an equally fascinating man as the ones you were describing just a second ago. And I'm very happy to have spent a little bit of time picking your brain on the relationship between South Africa and Germany and the many, many other experiences and opinions that you have garnered over the course of your interesting diplomatic career. Thank you so much, Ambassador.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
This is CliffCentral.com.